Hi, Alexis. Thanks for having me. So I don't know why you're so excited, but so a little bit about me is I make my living, and I have for 10 years, as a professional speaker and master of ceremonies. So I speak at association events or company meetings. And this is something that I had always wanted to do. And 10 years ago during the recession, I got laid off and I just dove in. And 10 years later, I still make my living getting to get up and speak at corporate events and the like. I do training for companies on how to help their people get across the gap from potential to performance. And it's been a lot of fun. So, you know, I was in sales and marketing for 20 years. And when you're in sales and marketing, you go to a lot of business conferences, right? And I would sit in the audience and I would watch the keynote speaker. And sometimes they'd be celebrities or, you know, or whatever, famous people. But oftentimes it was just somebody who had some business theory and some experience. And I would literally sit in my chair and watch them speak and think to myself, they have a better job than I do. I want to do that. And it took me 15 years to ever be bold or to be a shaker and to go do that. But once I finally got around to it, it's been a great thing. But I spent 20 years with my ladder of my career against the wrong wall, and I was successful, but I've been much happier the last decade being able to sort of carve my own path in the world. And I probably have not made as much money as I would have if I had stayed as a corporate marketing director. But at the same time, I'm much happier. And you know, I've been an example, I hope, for my kids that you have to do it your way. No, in fact, the world tries to tell you the opposite. Society wants you in a box. They want you to be so big, and they want you to be blue, and they want to put you on a shelf. Well, and we have access because of podcasts and because of blogs and because of the internet to people who are doing things. And I always say when I start my own podcast, my episodes, I say the reason I do this is success leaves clues. So if we can listen to successful people, we don't even know what the nugget or the information or the theory or the idea is going to be, but success leaves clues. And we didn't have that when I was coming up. But you had to live in their city in order to get in front of them. Absolutely. I wish I was 20 something now instead of 50 something. Yeah, and it literally is. So I have a kid who just graduated from college with a business degree from one of the top universities in the world. I mean, not even arguably, definitely one of the top universities on the planet. And she opted not to take a job with a giant corporation. She instead decided that she was going to maybe work for a boutique company and start her own fitness training company and then do some freelance work so that she could have control over her days. She's 22. She just graduated college and she's engaged to be married. I don't know how any of that happened. Minutes ago. And I have another one who's going to be a senior in high school. So we're almost done. So for 10 years, I've been a professional speaker, and I started off teaching people how to connect better. In a world where everybody was moving to their phones, I was talking about human-to-human engagement, networking, the reason people matter. And I started my podcast 5 years ago, and from the beginning, I realized it was the greatest networking tool I ever had. It's called Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do, and I interview people who are entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, the CEOs, and even people who have jobs but have that entrepreneurial spirit. And what's interesting is being a podcast host gave me access, like I said, success leaves clues. It gave me access to people I never would have had access to. In almost 500 episodes over 5 years, I've only had 3 people tell me, no, I don't want to do the show. Everybody else has said yes. And then those people were all sort of celebrities who I wasn't a big enough deal. They were judging my downloads or whatever. It was, you know, it was about their ego, not my show. And the reality is everybody, like all that, it's called Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do. I only want to interview cool people. If someone's going to be like, well, you're not a big enough deal for me, then I don't want them on the show anymore. No. Well, I did it for most of my life. I mean, I found a lot of reasons to say no to things. And it turns out what I've discovered from some research I've done on potential and why some people achieve it and don't, I learned that I was one of those people who typically didn't do things I didn't think I'd be good at. So I skipped over saying yes to opportunities because I was afraid, what if I failed? And instead of saying, what if I succeeded? So I've tried to change that. You know, I don't think it was a pain point. When I turned 50, I made a personal pledge that I was going to make age 50 to 75 the best years of my life. And I have a caveat to that. I had a really good life so far. So it wasn't like, oh, life sucked. I'm going to make the next 25 years better. The other thing is people often say, well, what about 75 to 100? You know what? I look back to when I was like 25, and that was literally a lifetime ago. My kids weren't born yet. I'll cross 75 when I get to it. So my dad lived to be 99 years old. He died shy of his 100th birthday. And up until about the last year, he was pretty spry and had it together. And so I don't remember him until he was almost 60. He was 52 years old when I was born. And I don't have any memories really of him until I'm, I don't know, 7 or 7. So he was 59, 60 years old. And yet he was always really active. He was always good. He cared for my mom got sick when I was a teenager. He retired when I was in 8th grade. And after I went to college and my mom passed away, we kind of thought, well, you know, he was 70. How long could he live? Well, it turns out he lived 30 years and had a pretty great life. And I thought, you know, why wait till you're 70? I'm just going to start saying yes to stuff. I'm going to start just living. And so I made that pledge, and along with it came my new motto, which is try new things, because I always only tried things if I was comfortable with them. So I have done all kinds of things in the last 3 years. I jumped off the Stratosphere Hotel. They have that 108-story out jump called the Sky Jump, where you go on like a tension wire outside the building, take 19 seconds from a platform on the 108th floor to the ground. I've done that twice. By the way, I'm petrified of heights. I went zip lining in Costa Rica and at Pikes Peak. Again, the person running the Pikes Peak, like zip lining, asked me, are you sure you want to keep going? Because I was clearly petrified. And I was, of course I'm going to keep going because I'm trying new things. You know, not pooping my pants was what I was trying to do. But I've done that. I've done all kinds of things. I had when I was a kid, I wanted to be an actor, and I never did anything about it. I mean, I did high school theater, but I never pursued it. And here's the worst part. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I never did anything with this drive inside of me. I wanted to do that. Now, I think that's how I became a speaker. I think it puts me on stage. I get to speak. Oh, I'm not doing plays. I'm you know, doing corporate training. But I think that's how I ended up there. But I ended up through sort of the back door. And so I ended up getting on in a short movie. A friend of mine was an actor, and he was doing some college and some private little short, you know, nothing that was going to go to the Academy Awards or anything. But I ended up getting a part in a little 7-minute movie. And so I was able to check the box that I was in a movie. And so I just started saying yes, and it has boldly, and it has changed my world. I wish I had adopted this as my lifestyle when I was 20. Well, so I think the biggest thing that I've done in this whole adventure the last 3 years of just saying yes and trying new things, a year ago, I was going to be in New York giving a speech, and I reached out to a couple of friends of mine from the National Speakers Association who I wouldn't say were great friends, but I knew them, and I was actually at a conference, and this one guy was there. I said, oh, I'm going to be in New York in, I don't know, 3 weeks. And he said, oh, great. Now, this guy speaks on humor in the workplace, and his TED Talk has been watched over 2 million times. This guy's a big deal. Yeah, he is a big deal. He's an engineer who became an improv and professional comic. He's a young guy, but he now speaks all over the world about, you know, how to find humor and use humor in the workplace. And so he's kind of a big deal. And I was like, let's go have a drink. And he goes, and he's a professional comic. He goes, why don't you come to open mic night with me? And my answer was, oh my God, I would love to watch you work on new material. I love my whole life. I've loved going to comedy shows. I've never been to an open mic night. And sometimes you're at a coffee house or a bar and they have a sign that says open mic Thursday night, or a comedy club after the show. They go, stay, we have open mic night. I'd never been to one. And I thought, how fun to watch comics work on new stuff. And the other guy who was with him was standing over his shoulder, shaking his head, saying, that's not what he's inviting you to do. He's inviting you to go to the comedy club and get up and do 5 minutes at an open mic night. And I'm like, that's what he does, right? He's all about finding humor. And so he tells his friends, come to open mic night with me, prepare 5 minutes and get up, you know, just try it. And most people say no to him. But some people say yes. And this one friend had done it and said, it was interesting. I learned a little. And my answer was no. And he said, now, like, he goes, we're not that close. He goes, I'm not going to force you to do this. He goes, but let's unpack this a little bit. Why are you so viscerally no? And I said, because that's stand-up comedy. That's different than what I do. And he goes, well, you're funny. You know, I've talked to you in a bar and, you know, I've seen you speak. You're humorous. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, did you ever want to do it? And then I kind of lit up and I said, yeah, as a kid, I wanted to be an actor. And in fact, when I was 16, I used to go to the Ice House in Pasadena, which is still one of the most famous comedy clubs in the country. And we would watch comics. I mean, I remember seeing Paula Poundstone before she was famous, Jay Leno before he was the host of the Tonight Show. And I was always dragging my friends to go do that. And you could get free tickets to see the Tonight Show when Johnny Carson was hosting it. We used to drive after class to Hollywood and go watch the show. And I like lit up and I'm telling these stories about how my whole life I loved watching comedy. He goes, did you ever want to get up? And I'm like, yeah, I wanted to be an actor or a comic. And he goes, well, why not just do it? And I'm like, I'm not going to do this in New York. Like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it at home at like a coffee shop where there's like six people. I'm not going to a club in Greenwich Village and doing 5 minutes of stand-up. And he kind of prodded me a little bit. And I said, I'll think about it. And then he emailed me and said, are we doing this? And I said, yes. And so what I did is I pulled out all the funny moments from my keynotes where I get the audience to laugh. And so I met him an hour before and he looked at what I was going to do. And he goes, well, this is speech humor. This isn't stand-up. And I'm like, well, audiences laugh at these. He goes, you only have 5 minutes. These are stories, dude. This will take you 15 minutes and you'll get like three laughs. And so he helped me punch it up. He found a couple of funny parts and they drew my name and it was my turn. And I got up there and I'll be honest, Jerry Seinfeld is not worried about job security because I did 5 minutes of stand-up at a mic night. However, I didn't suck. And it was funny because a couple of comics came up to me and said, that was your first time because we announced it. And I said, yeah. And they were like, wow, that was one of the better first times I've ever seen. And the reason wasn't that I was funny. It's that I had stage presence. I mean, these comics, what I've learned in the past, that was a year ago. That was 14 months ago. What I've learned in the last 14 months is these comics spend 10 years going to open mic nights and doing little dive shows in order to get comfortable on stage. Well, I've given over 850 corporate presentations. You know, I mean, I can do two and three a week. So I was up there. I kind of had fun. So I decided. So I made the decision that because it was fun and I learned a little, and I'll tell you what, having given 850 professional speeches, stand-up comedy is the hardest use of the spoken word. It was scary. It was harder. Where if I'm speaking for an hour and I don't feel I have the audience, I've got 45 minutes to kind of pull them back in. Open mic night, you got 4 or 5 minutes. They get a laugh every 30 seconds. So I made a pledge I was going to do 100 open mic nights. And I just started telling my friends, I'm going to do this 100 times. And I thought when I traveled, I would just look it up. I'm in a hotel room a lot. So I'd just look up where's an open mic night in Kansas City or whatever. And then I started going at home. And now I go once a week, whether I'm home or away. And my wife has just said, all right, whatever, Tuesday night's your night. So if I'm in town, I go locally. If I'm out of town, I find an open mic night in whatever city I'm in. And I have now done 55 open mic nights. And I've been invited to do, I've done two and invited to do a third show. Now, these aren't like Netflix special level shows, but they're like comedy shows that take place on like a Friday night in like a coffee house or something. I did one in Phoenix. I did one in Austin and I've got another one scheduled. Yeah. And you're invited to do like 10 minutes. And yeah. And so that's what I'm doing is like my little side hobby. I'm not writing comedy during the day. I'm not, you know, traveling the country doing it, but a couple hours a week, I'm trying to learn the craft of what it means to really do stand up. And the byproduct is it's making me a better public speaker. And I think it's making me a better person because I'm learning a lot. Judy Carter's book. Yeah. Yeah, no, my kids are now worried about everything that happens. Like, this isn't going to end up in a speech in your stand-up, is it? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like people go, okay. My friends are like, okay, funny boy, say something funny. I'm like, yeah, it doesn't really work that way. I will tell you, especially because in the beginning, like anything, you suck. And I said earlier, I think I was one of these people who only did things that I was naturally good at. And so while I had the stage presence, I wasn't getting laughs. I was getting a lot of like, yeah. And I think it was somewhere around 25 or 30 before I started actually figuring out sort of the timing, sort of what was funny, how to shorten, because as a speaker, I have a lot of time. So how do you shorten things down to 20 seconds? That's only a handful of words. I made the pledge I was going to do it 100 times to see what I learned. And I'm always looking to sort of what can I learn, because it works its way into my work, because I teach people in corporate America. So I like to have interesting examples. And I thought, well, this would be interesting to say I did 100 open mic nights and have some sort of a business lesson out of it. But it's become much more than that. And one thing is that I would go into these comedy clubs. I remember being in San Diego and I was still no good. And I went to the comedy club at an open mic night and they had it every night. And so I went every night at like 9:30. And nobody would talk to me. Now I'm used to being at business events where if someone's standing around, someone else walks up and goes, hey, you know, what made you come to this conference or whatever? People looked at me like, who brought their dad? All of these comics, mostly young men, looked at me like, who is this guy? And, you know, this is audio, your people can't see me. I mean, oh, it's video. Oh, great. I'm picking my nose and stuff. I didn't know. I look like I stepped out of Accountants Today magazine, right? I mean, I look like, if you remember the show Happy Days, I look like Richie Cunningham grew up. Didn't get as ugly as Ron Howard. I still have my hair, but literally nobody talks to me. I mean, I come in, I look like I'm an accountant, and you know, I look like their dad. And I found that very hard, because I'd try to make eye contact, I'd try to join conversations. And it was really hard, but at the same time, all of a sudden it made me so much more empathetic to people who are shy, or people who have more of an alternative lifestyle, who walk into a corporate event, or maybe people who are of a certain ethnic group to walk into a group that's all white. And all of a sudden I started realizing that going through this and being not shunned, but being ignored was a learning experience I needed to have. And so, you know, it's impacting myself with my own bias and my own privilege to be able to be on the other side of that. Now, locally in Austin, once I started to get better, once I started to be able to put together a kind of a tight five or you know, tight 5 minutes, all of a sudden some of the other comics would come up and talk to me afterwards. They'd say, hey, good set. And then one day I walked in and this group was sitting there and they're all like 23 years old. And they kind of said, hey, come here. And I came over and I joined them and they said, okay, they go, last week, they go, that line you had about your son. And by the way, I have two daughters in real life, but I don't want to mock them. So I've created fake kids for the comedy. Like, talk about my family in corporate settings, it's always truthful. But I decided for comedy, I could have like kind of a fake family that I could mock. And they said, they go, that line about your son. And there was one line and they go, that was the funniest line of the whole night. And so we started talking about it. And the one guy said, yeah, because we've seen you around. So we looked you up. And they're like, you're a professional speaker. This is what you do. And so then they were all interested in, how do you get a career? How do you do that? And so all of a sudden, you know, not that I'm one of the cool kids, I don't get like a pass to the cool kids table, but I now have developed some friendships with some of these comics and I'm learning about their lives and their struggles and what's brought them to comedy. And the fact that to be 25 and say, I'm going to go for this, you know, that's a bold shaker move. I mean, I wish I could go back and be 25 and follow all my dreams, whether I reached them or not. Well, my dad lived to be 100. So based on that, I've still got 47 more years to go. So I've listened to a lot of stuff about how, not that I'm seeking to become a professional comic, but I've looked at how do you grow the craft? And there's a lot of talk about you have to start young because it takes 10 years or. And I listen to these things and I laugh because it's like Rodney Dangerfield was in his 50s when he started. You know, there's a lot of examples of people in actors. Samuel L. Jackson was broke in 50 before he started acting. Yeah, well, absolutely. And so I look at it as maybe the fact that I learned to do this and take bold actions at 50, maybe that's what I'm supposed to do. Maybe I'm the person who's going to help some other people, because I think the millennials are going to freak out when they turn 50. Just because, you know, I think that turning 50 for a lot of my friends was really hard. And I think the millennials have spent so much time, even more so than the baby boomers back in the 70s, kind of knocking the older generations. That when they reach it, I think they're going to look in the mirror and go, "Oh my God, we're the problem." So that's one of my lines in my stand-up is I talk about how much I like the fact that the world has changed and that we, you know, we're so aware now of diversity. Except I'm not allowed to talk about that because I'm a 52-year-old white guy, so apparently I am the problem. I mentor two young gentlemen who both sort of found me accidentally about 6 or 7 years ago, and they've never gone away. My wife and kids refer to them as my fake sons. They're both 29. One of them turns 30 this week. And I met them when they were both new to Austin, and they both separately said, would you be my mentor? And I said, I really don't know what that means, but you're welcome to call me. And you know, you fast forward 7 years, they're like best friends. Their friend groups have merged. And they really are two of my closest friends. But one of them was making a big job change. And he was calling me like every day about what was going on and negotiating his salary and looking at this. And when it was all over, he said, how does somebody do this without you? Like, he was like, I don't understand how I could have done this. And I said, well, we've all done it. We just made the mistakes. You know, it's like having that guide, having somebody who's walked in the moccasins a little bit ahead of you, it really can be helpful. So part of what I teach is the importance of mentors. And it doesn't have to be the younger person to the older person. I have mentors who are younger than me. They just happen to have experiences. Who brought their dad? Well, just do it. I mean, realistically, what's the worst thing? If you listen to this saying, wow, I've always wanted to go do an open mic night. I've always wanted to do stand-up. So what's the worst thing that happens?
Get up there.
Yeah, but the flip side of it is that the people, you know, you tell them it's your first time. People are supportive. They want to see you get up there. You know, when I see other people come for their first time, the comics all go, oh, it's his first time. They all applaud, even if they're horrible. And if you want to get better at something, it takes stage time. I mean, that's one of the things I'm learning from these comics is that you have to get up time after time. I mean, the people who I've seen really grow, like over the past year, who are the ones who really want to become professional comics, they're doing 5-6 open mic nights a week. I'm doing one. So some of these people are out there just constantly doing it, getting their 5 minutes and going and trying it and changing the same joke and changing a word. So if you want to just try something, go try it. If you want to get good at something, it really does take the reps. You have to get out there time after time after time. And, you know, I decided I was going to do 100 open mic nights and someone said, well, you quit after 100. I said, I don't know, but I've decided that the lesson is in the 100 open mic nights. And now I'm getting asked to do some of these shows. And you know, what does that mean? Well, it's making me a better speaker. I also MC events and I MC'd a large event for a giant association of people who work for cities. And I had done it 2 years in a row. And after the second time, the meeting planner came up and said, okay, I brought you back because you're good. You were better. What's the difference? And I said, it's the stand-up comedy. And she said, well, you weren't up there doing jokes. And I said, no, but I've learned to be more playful with an audience. I mean, I've just learned that, you know, I can get up and say things. If it doesn't work, that's okay. And I've bombed on open mic night. And I know that on a stage for a corporate thing, I'm not going to bomb. I'm also not going to get up and do, you know, jokes. I'm not going to get up and do a shtick. But what I've learned from being on those stages and being around these comics who are really dedicated to it is I've learned how to just be more confident and be more playful. And it's seeping into my work. And I think that that's this whole point about realizing that sometimes you have to step out of your comfort zone. You have to say yes to things you're not assured you're going to be good at, because that's how you grow. And I, like I said, I spent too long, you know, I went into sales and marketing because I was good at it. I didn't have my ladder against the right wall for 20 years, but I was good at it. So I did it. And so I think that's the thing. It's finding something you're not good at, and it's okay if people mock doing it, and then go do it 100 times. Yeah. Well, if you go and see the musical Hamilton in New York, the actors that you're watching did not pick up the script for the first time that morning and then get out there and just rap. They have rehearsed and they have tried. They've done the reps. They've had a director. They've had the stage time, and then they're ready for prime time. So you've got to get out there and really, you know, practice. I mean, that's the thing. I do some speech coaching for executives. And one of the things I say is, how often have you rehearsed the speech? And a lot of them go, oh, I don't. Well, I do. You know, I'm a professional speaker. I rehearse. But very few people wing it. Even the ones who look like they're winging it very often didn't wing it. I have a friend who was a professional comic for a while, and she actually knew Robin Williams in not his early days, but sort of the medium years. And she said it was interesting to watch how much he rehearsed and how often he went to open mic nights to try new material. And then when he got up on stage, it looked like it was a stream of consciousness, but it really wasn't. You bet. I don't know. I'm waiting to see, you know, what the next thing that comes forward that someone offers me a chance to do. In addition to my podcast, I had a client call me and they wanted to start a podcast and they said, would you be our host? And I'm like, I don't know. I've never hosted anybody else's show. And I started looking into it and there's a whole need for it. There's a lot of organizations who don't have somebody on staff who can do what I can do. And so I'm trying to put together a little speakers bureau for people who want to host shows for associations or companies. And I've started doing this one show and we're going to launch it in early June for the association. And then if we build that up, I'm hoping to do two or three more. And then I'm going to try to help other people get booked as talent for podcasts. So and the other thing is that people talk about, like, they'll listen to my podcast and they'll be like, oh, you're really good at that. I go, yeah, don't go listen to episode number like 1 through 100. Again, it's much like the comedy. I had to do a couple hundred episodes before the show got good. So for a large brand, one of the things is nobody is the face of a large brand. It's one thing if you're me, right? I'm a solopreneur. But if you're a large brand, the problem is for an association, some companies, they don't have somebody, A, who has the personality and the experience to host the show. A lot of them don't want to give that power to anybody. I know two or three companies who have talked to me about maybe down the line they want to find somebody because they let like their salesman run the podcast and then he left to go to a competitor. And so it's like, you know, so it's like if you give it to an employee and that employee leaves, they're the face of your podcast dies. The other thing is that like for associations, they're volunteers, you know, oh yeah, Bobby would love to host it until Bobby doesn't want to do it anymore. Now you've lost your host. So by hiring somebody, you know, CBS just doesn't pull anybody off the board to do the news. They hire a professional news person. And so a lot of people are thinking, look, if we want to make this an ongoing thing, it would be nice to have a trained, seasoned, experienced personality. And so when you say what's next, that sort of fell into my lap. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I'm going to run with it. And I don't know where it goes, but I'm trying to make their podcast kick ass. And then after that, I want to pick up two or three more clients. Then I want to become the guy who helps other podcasters find that and help people realize that this is a thing. You can hire talent to make your show better. Well, and the show that I'm doing it's a technical organization and I'm not a techie. So I don't know anything. I don't even know where to go with the questions. So what we do is we have right now, one of their board members is co-hosting it. And so we're doing two things. I'm trying to learn their business. He's also trying to learn how to host it. And after a year, maybe I'll host it. Maybe he'll host it. Maybe we'll remain co-hosts. We don't know, but we're doing this dance together because there's no way he could have stepped in and run the interview until he's done, you know, 6 months worth of shows. And so they brought me in, you know, to be sort of that face and they're really open about it, that maybe I'm the face forever. Maybe I'm the face for 6 months while he gets up to speed. Right. And so, you know, but it's a learning curve. And for me, it's fun. And they're a client that I've worked with as a speaker. And so they know me and their audience knows me. And so we're actually working really well together. And, you know, in 6 months, we're going to revisit and see where it is. But like I said, I'm actually actively looking for like two other associations who want to have, you know, someone who has experience interviewing people so that they can create sort of a high energy show. You know, and it would be nice if it was something maybe not as technical where every time we do a show, I'm like having to read for an hour beforehand. So I speak for large association conferences like annual meetings, and I do a program called the Conference Catalyst. People go to those meetings because they want to connect, and then when they get there, they suck at it. And so I help people realize in a gadget crazy world, how do we get back to the human side of having conversations, of talking to people, of your network, of your brand, et cetera. And then I also have a program that I do inside companies for team meetings, although I've done it as a keynote at associations, called the Paradox of Potential. And it's all about if you've got a team full of people who have potential, but they're not reaching their results, they're not hitting their peak performance, we can talk about what's holding them back and then create customized paths across that gap. I'm industry agnostic. In the last month, I've spoken for healthcare. I've spoken for lawyers. One of my biggest clients a few years ago was NATSO. Do you know NATSO? It's the National Association of Truck Stop Operators. There's an association for everybody, and I can speak for. Yeah, in fact, it's the number one question I teach people to ask is, why did you come to this event? Because you came for a reason, but other people came for other reasons you haven't thought of. So two things happen. When they tell you, now you're like, oh, that's a good reason to be here. And number two, they've basically told you how you can help them, because they've told you what their need is, why they showed up. And then maybe you can be the connector that makes it all better for them. And isn't it surprising when you get that person who goes, I don't support charity? I actually had a person, we were raising some money for someone, her nephew needed a wheelchair. We were walking around a party collecting $2, $5, whatever we could get. And I went up to this one guy who was kind of well known in the tech community out in Silicon Valley, but he was here in Austin. And I said, you know, hey, we're just doing this. And he goes, oh, I don't give money to people. And it was like, really? Ew, that's gross. And I've never forgotten that. It was always like, I forgot my wallet. It's a better answer. People lie to me all the time. Please don't tell me that you don't believe in giving and supporting people in need. Awesome. I don't think that's the saying, but okay. And anyway, people can find me at thomsinger.com. thomsinger.com. But I'll let you know a secret. If you were to spell Tom, T-O-M, and went to thomsinger.com, it would redirect. I own them both. So no, but the first show I did, I was a late ad, so my name didn't show up on their like little digital poster that they made. The second one, my name did, and so I printed it out the size of like a 4x6 photograph, and I got paid for doing that show. That was a paid comic gig. I got $10, so I took the $10 and I framed it with everything. I figured, you know, I could spend the $10 on, you know, half a glass of wine at the W Hotel, or I could frame it and say, look, I got paid. And so I keep telling my kids, remember, dad is a professional stand-up comic. Because I got paid $10 one time. Thank you. I believe it. Thank you.